5. When dinner was done, the Waylord invited our guests to come with him to his apartments, glancing at me to assure me I was welcome. We made our way at the slow pace of his lameness back through the corridors and past the deserted rooms and inner courts. We sat in the back gallery. The evening light was fading in the windows.
"I think we have a good deal to talk about," the Waylord said to his guests.
He looked at them both, and the flash of opal fire was in his eyes.
"Grybarra says that you came to Ansul in part to find me, and Memer told me that her meeting with you was blessed by Lero. I am sure of that blessing. But may I ask why you sought me?"
"May I tell you all the story?" Caspero asked. The Waylord laughed and said,
"Shall I allow the sun to shine, or permit the river to run?"
"That is what Raniu said when the great harper Moro asked him if he might play his harp in the temple." Caspero began hesitantly. "Because of what books were to me when I was a boy, because what was written was a light in darkness to me." He paused. "Then, when I came down to the cities and began to learn how much there was to be learned, I was half in despair."
"You were a calf in clover," Gry said.
"Well, yes, that too." We all laughed, and he went on more easily. "At any rate, as I see it,
making poetry is the least of what I do.
Finding what other makers made, speaking it, printing it, recovering it from neglect or oblivion, relighting the light of the word. This is the chief work of my life. So when I'm not earning my living in the marketplace, I'm in the library or the book dealer's stall or the scholar's den, asking about books and writings, learning about forgotten makers, those known only in their city or country. And everywhere I've been, in Bendramen, Urdale, the city-states, Valdalva, in every university or library or marketplace, the wisest, most learned people speak of the learning of Ansul and the library of Ansul."
"In the past tense," said the Waylord.
"Waylord, I work with what's lost, buried, hidden. Lost by time and ill chance, maybe, or hidden from destruction, from the prejudice of a ruler or a priest. In the foundations of the old council halls of Messun, in Urdale we found the earliest of all the testaments of the life of Raniu, written on calfskin, and sealed in an unmarked vault 500 years ago, in the reign of the tyrant Terenza. He drove out teachers, and destroyed temples and writings throughout the city. He ruled for 40 years. The Alds have ruled Ansul only 17 years.
"Memer's lifetime," the Waylord said. "A lot can be lost in 17 years. A generation learns that knowledge is punished, and safety lies in ignorance. The next generation doesn't know they're ignorant, because they don't know what knowledge was. Those who came after Terenza and Messun didn't dig up the buried writings. They didn't know of them.
A rumor survived," Caspero said.
"There are always rumors."
"I follow them."
"Was it some particular rumor that brought you here? The name of a lost maker? A lost poem?"
"Mostly the reputation of Ansul as the center of learning and of writing in all the western shore. What most drew me was the tale, the rumor, of a great library that was here even before the founding of the University of Ansul. In it were said to be writings from the days when we still spoke Aratan, and had some memory of the lands beyond the desert from which we came. Perhaps there were even books brought from the sunrise across the desert, in the beginning of our history. I have longed for years to come here, to ask, to seek any knowledge of that library."
The Waylord said nothing,
made no response.
I know that my quest puts me in some danger. It puts in worse danger every man I speak to about it, even if he doesn't answer.
The Waylord nodded slightly. His face was expressionless.
I know the Alds, Caspar said. We lived among them some while. That took courage. Less than I ask of you.
I could hardly bear it, the suppressed passion in both of them, the fire and fear and challenge. I wanted to say to them, shout at them, trust each other, can't you trust each other? And knew it was foolish, childish, and wanted to cry. Gryberin nudged Shatar. The lion got up and lounged over to me and sat on her haunches in her peaceable, sleepy fashion right in front of my legs, so that I could scratch her ears. I did that, and the touch soothed me. Gry looked at us. She didn't quite wink, but I thought I read in her look something like, "They're men. This is the only way they know how to do it." The Waylord had risen to fetch a candle. I should have done that, but he was already bringing the heavy iron candlestick to the table, awkwardly, having little grip in his hands. Gry lit the candle with the strike box. The light bloomed, making the rest of the room dark, and our faces vivid against the darkness and the faint glimmer of the windows. Shatar gave a grunt and sank down at my feet in picture-book lion pose, front paws outstretched, eyes gazing at the light.
"I revised my opinion of courage," the Waylord said, "while I was in the Gaan's prison. I thought it was something a man owed himself, like pride or self-respect. I learned that we owe it only to the gods."
His gaze, too, was on the steady yellow flame of the candle. Caspero did not speak.
"I was taken there," he went on, "because they, like you, had heard tales and rumors. Tales and rumors that brought them here, to Anzul. Do you know why the Alds invaded my country and laid siege to my city?"
"I thought greed, envy of your green lands."
"Why this green land? For Dalva is closer, and as unwarlike as we are. You say you lived a while in Asudar. Tell me then, if I go astray. The Alds have a king, a Gond of Gonds, who is also the high priest of Atth. His power is great. All slaves are his to claim. He commands the armies."
Caspero nodded.
"The name of this priest-king who took the throne of Asudar 30 years ago is Dorad. He believes that Atth wishes him to combat evil on earth. Atth is what the Alds call the only god they acknowledge. It means Lord. The true name of Atth is not spoken. All good belongs to Atth. But there is a great power of evil, and it is called Obath, the other lord."
Again Caspero nodded. The Waylord asked,
"Do you know the story of the 1,000 true men?"
"The Alds say that if 1,000 true soldiers could be gathered together, Obath could be vanquished forever. Or some say 100.
And some say 10, said Gry.
The Waylord smiled, though not with much cheer.
"I like that version," he said. "Did they say where these true men were to meet?"
"No." Caspero looked at Gry, who also shook her head.
"Well, the story was told me in a manner that made it hard to forget. It was the son of our Gond here, Idor, son of Ireth, who told it to me. Many times. He paused for a while, and then said, very low, "I don't like to speak it here in this house. Forgive me. This is what I was told. All light and righteousness belong to Apth, the burning god, whose power is visible in the sun. There is nothing sacred outside the fire of Apth. All fire is holy for his sake. The moon they despise, calling it the slave, the witch. The earth is a place of exile, a foul place, unholy, infested by demons, utterly cold and dark but for the light and warmth reflected on it by the sun of Ath. And on earth, Obath, the enemy of Ath, is manifest in the evil fortunes of men, and the evil men do, and the evil spirits they worship, and most of all, in one certain place. In that place, all the foulness of earth gathers together, darkness drawing inward into earth, the reverse of light shining out from the sun. It is an anti-sun that eats light. It is black, wet, cold, vile. As the sun is being, it is unbeing. A void, a great hole in the earth, deep beyond depth. It is called the Night Mouth. And it is there that the thousand true men are to gather to bear the fire of Ath into the kingdom of Obath. They will enter the darkness, make war on the other lord, and destroy him. Then they will come forth with their banners of flame, and all earth will burn as bright as the sun, both night and day. All demons and shadows will be driven into outer darkness beyond the stars, and the sons of Asudar will rule over all men in righteousness, worshipping the burning god.
The Waylord's voice was monotonous and rough, scarcely audible, and I saw that his hands were clenched, one in the other.
Old traditions of Asudar said that the Night Mouth was in the west, on the coast. Dorid, the priest-king in his city Madrone, ordered the lesser priests of Ath to find this center of darkness. Some thought the mountain Sul itself contained the Night Mouth, but the others said no. Sul, they said, is a volcano. It contains fire, and so is sacred to Ath. Opposite it, across the water from it, would be the dark place, the bottomless well of evil. The Night Mouth would be found here, in the city of Ansul. It is supposed to be guarded by a wizard of terrible powers, who can summon armies of evil spirits, the foul emanations of the earth. And the gods of the heathen will gather to defend it, the thousand false gods. So the armies of Asudar were sent to take the country and city of Ansul by force and find the Night Mouth. When it is found, King Dorid will send the thousand true men into it with banners of fire, a burning army. Light will banish darkness, and good will vanquish evil.
He drew a harsh breath. He bit his lips and looked away from the candle, hiding his face in shadow. "I never heard that tale," Caspero said. His own voice was shaken. He spoke, I think, to give the Waylord time to recover himself. "Tales of how Earth is the battlefield of Ath and Obath, yes. An unending war. And people in the desert knew there was a mountain called Sul far in the west. An uncanny place, but only because it's surrounded by the sea.
Salt water they call the curse of Oboth. This tale of the night mouth must be a secret knowledge. Priestly lore. Useful to justify an invasion, said Gry. If so, it would be more widely known, wouldn't it? Do the common soldiers know the story, Waylord?
I don't know. I know they were told to search for certain things. Certain houses. Caves. Wizards. Idols. Books. There are many caves in the hills above the city. And idols and books, there was no end of them in Ansul. The soldiers were diligent.
We were all silent for a while. How are you governed? Gry asked. There was something in her voice. It wasn't as beautiful as her husband's voice. But there was something in it that relieved me, quieted me, the way touching the lion's fur did. When the Waylord answered her, he sounded a little less strained.
We're enslaved, not governed. The Gondiaroth and his officers are all the law. For the most part, we of Ansul hold the city together by doing things as we used to do them, as best we can, while the Alds exact tribute and punish blasphemy and hold aloof. They'd lived here as soldiers in a garrison ever since they took the city. They sent no colonists. They brought no women. They don't want to live here. They hate it. Land and city and sea. The earth itself is a place of exile to them, and this is the worst of it.
In the silence that followed, Shatar raised her head from her paws, said, "Rawr," in a deep, throaty voice, and yawned mightily. "You're right," Gry said to her. She and Caspero rose to say good night, thanking the Waylord for his hospitality, and thanking me, too. I gave her an oil lamp with a mica shade to light the way to their room. I saw that both she and her husband touched the god niche by the door as they left the room. I watched them go down the corridor side by side, his hand on her shoulder, the lion pacing softly after them, and the glimmer of the lamp running along the bare stone walls. I turned back to see the Waylord gazing at the candle, his face very weary. I thought how alone he was. His friends came and went again, and here he must stay. I had thought of his solitude as his choice, his nature, maybe because it came so natural to me. But he had no choice. He looked up at me.
"What have you brought to Galfamond?"
he said. I was frightened by his tone. I said at last, "Friends, I think."
"Oh, yes. Powerful friends, Mimir."
"Waylord."
"Well?"
"This Nightmouth, this Oboth, did they come here to the house, to Galfamond? The Red Hats, the soldiers, did they take you to prison? Because they thought..." He didn't answer for a while. He sat stiffly, his shoulders hunched, as he did when in pain.
"Yes,"
he said. "But is it... is there anything here?" I didn't know what I was asking. But he did. He looked up at me, a fierce look.
"What they seek is theirs. It's in their hearts, not ours. This house hides no evil. They bring their darkness with them. They will never know what is in the heart of this house. They will not look. They will not see. That door will never open to them. You needn't fear, Mimir. You can't betray it. I tried to betray it over and over. But the gods of my house and the shadows of my dead forgave me before I could do it. They wouldn't let me do it. All the hands of all the givers of dreams were on my mouth.
I was very frightened now. He had never spoken of the torture. He was clenched and hunched and trembling. I wanted to go to him, but did not dare. He made a slight gesture and whispered,
"Go on. Go to bed, child."
I went forward and put my hand on his.
"I'm all right," he said. "Listen, you did right to bring them here. You brought blessing. Always, Mimir. Now go on."
I had to leave him sitting there, shaking, alone. I was tired. It had been a long day, an immense day, but I could not go to bed. I went to the wall under the hill and opened the door in it with the words written in air and went into the secret room. As I went into it, all at once I was afraid. My heart went cold. My hair stirred on my neck. That horrible image of a black sun that sucked out warmth and light from the world. It was like a hole in my mind now, sucking meaning out, leaving nothing but cold and emptiness. I had always been afraid of the far end of this long, strange room stretching off into darkness. I had kept away from the shadow end, turned my back on it, not thought about it, told myself, "That's something I'll understand later." Now it was later. Now I had to understand what my house was built on. But all I had to make understanding out of was that tale of a night mouth, that hateful image from the people I hated. And Orc Caspero's tale. A library, he had said. A great library. The greatest in the world. A place of learning. Of the light of the mind. I could not even look at the shadow end of the room. I wasn't ready yet for that. I had to gather my strength. I went to the table, the one I used to build houses under, and pretend to be a bear cub in its den. I set down the lamp and laid my hands palm down on the table, pressing them hard on the smooth wood to feel its smoothness, its solidity. It was there. There was a book on it. The two of us always returned books to the shelves before we left the room, an old habit of order the Waylord had from his mother, who had been his teacher as he was mine. I didn't recognize this book. It didn't look old. It must be one of those that people had brought him secretly to be hidden away, to be saved from the destruction of Oth. Occupied with learning all I could of the great makers of the past and the knowledge they had gathered, I had scarcely looked yet at the shelves that held those random, rescued, newer books. The Waylord must have set this one out for me while I went back to the market with Gry. I opened it and saw it was printed with the metal letters they use now in Vendramin and Ordele, which make it easy to make 1,000 copies of a book. I read the title, Chaos and Spirit, The Cosmogonies, and under that, the name Auric Caspero, and under that, the name of the printers, Bera and Holovan of Dereswater in Vendramin. On the next page were only the words, Made in honor and dear remembrance of Mele Aulita, of Caspermont. I sat down, facing the dark end of the room, for if I couldn't look at it, neither could I turn my back on it. I drew the lamp closer to the book and began to read. I woke there in the gray of early morning, the lamp dead, my head on the open book. I was chilled to the bone. My hands were so stiff I could barely write the letters on the air to leave the room. I ran to the kitchen and all but crawled into the fireplace, trying to get warm. Ista scolded, and Susta chattered, but I didn't listen. The great words of the poem were running in my head like waves, like flights of pelicans over the waves. I couldn't hear or see or feel anything but them. Ista was really worried about me. She gave me a cup of hot milk and said,
"Drink this, you fool girl. What are you taking sick for now? With guests in the house, drink it up."
I drank it and thanked her, and went to my room where I fell on the bed and slept like a stone till late in the morning. I found Gry and her husband in the stable-yard, with the lion and the horses, and Gudit and Sosta. Sosta was neglecting her sewing to swoon around Caspero. Gudit was saddling the tall red horse, and Gry and Caspero were arguing. They weren't angry with each other, but they weren't in agreement. Lyra was not in their hearts, as we say.
"You can't possibly go there by yourself,"
Gry was saying. And he was saying, "You can't possibly go there with me." And it was not the first time either had said it. He turned to me. For a moment I felt almost as swoony as Sosta, thinking that this was the man who had made the poem that I had read all night and that had remade my soul. That confusion went away at once. This was Auric Caspero, all right. Only not the poet Caspero, but the man Auric. A worried man, arguing with his wife. A man who took everything terribly seriously. Our guest, whom I liked.
"You can tell us, Mimir,"
he said. "People saw Gry in the marketplace yesterday. Saw her with Shatar. Hundreds of people. Isn't that true?"
"Of course it is,"
Gry said before I could speak. "But nobody saw inside the wagon, did they, Mimir?" "Yes," I said to him, and, "I don't think so," to her. "So," she said, "your wife hid in the wagon in the marketplace, and now stays indoors in the house like a virtuous woman. And your servant, the lion trainer, emerges from the wagon and comes with you to the palace." He was obstinately shaking his head.
"Auric, I traveled as a man with you for 2 months all over Asundar. What on earth makes it impossible now?"
"You'll be recognized. They saw you, Gry. They saw you as a woman."
"All unbelievers look alike. And the Alds don't see women anyhow."
"They see women with lions who frighten their horses."
"Auric, I am coming with you."
He was so distressed that she went to him and held him, pleading and reassuring.
"You know nobody in Asundar ever saw I was a woman except that old witch at the oasis, and she laughed about it, remember? They won't know, they won't see, they can't see. I will not let you go alone. I can't. You can't. You need Shatar, and Shatar needs me. Let me go dress now. There's plenty of time. I won't ride, you ride, and we'll walk with you. There'll be plenty of time, won't there, Mimir? How far is it to the palace?"
4 street crossings and 3 bridges.
See? I'll be back in no time. Don't let him go without me,"
she said to me and Gudit and Sosta, and perhaps to the horse, and she ran off to the back of the house, Shatar loping along with her. Auric walked to the gateway of the court and stood there straight and stiff, his back turned to us all. I felt sorry for him.
"Stands to reason," Gudit said. "Murderous snakes they are in that palace, what they call it. Our council house it was. Get over there, you."
The tall red horse looked at him with mild reproach and moved politely to the left. "What a beauty you are," I said to the horse, for he was. I patted his neck.
"Brandy?"
"Branty," Auric said, coming back to us with an air of dignified defeat that you could see went right to Sosta's heart.
"Oh,"
she said to Auric, and then trying to cover it up,
"oh, can I get you a—"
But she couldn't think of anything to get him.
"He's a good old fellow,"
Auric said, taking up Branty's reins. He made as if to mount, but Gudit said,
"Hold on, wait a minute. Have to look to the cinch here,"
getting between him and the horse and throwing the stirrup up over the saddle. Auric gave up and stood as patiently as the horse.
"Have you had him a long time?"
I asked, trying to make a conversation and feeling as foolish as Sosta.
"He's well over 20. Time he had a rest from traveling. And Star as well."
He smiled a little sadly.
"We left the uplands together, Branty and me, Star and Gry, and Coley, our dog. A good dog. Gry trained her."
That got Gudit started off on the follow-hounds that used to live at Galvamond,
and he was still talking about them when Gry reappeared. She wore breeches and a rough tunic. Men in Ansul wear their hair long, tied back, so she had merely combed out her braid and put on a worn black velvet cap. She had somehow darkened or roughened her chin. She had become a fellow of 25 or so, quick-eyed, shy, and sullen.
"So are we ready?"
she said, and her soft, burry voice had changed too, becoming hoarse. Sosta was staring at her, rapt.
"Who are you?"
she asked. Gry rolled her eyes and said,
"Chai the Lion Tamer."
"So, Auric?"
He gazed at her, shrugged, laughed a little, and swung up onto the horse. "Come on, then," he said, and set right off, not looking back. She and the lion followed behind him. She looked back at me as they passed through the gate, and winked.
"But where did he come from?"
Sosta asked.
"Merciful Ennu, go with them, that nest of murderous rats and snakes they're going to,"
Gudit said, hollowly, shuffling into the stable. I went in to look after the gods and the ancestors, and find out what Ista needed from the market.